Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 10th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. We welcome back Dr. Valerie Rapson, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. You know, we'll talk about dark matter today, warped space-time, galaxies merging. If you have any questions about that stuff, give a call. But if there's something in the sky, some astronomical object you've seen, you want to know what it is, you can do that too. Simple or difficult, that's the way we roll. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 if you have an astronomy question, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Get ready, get set. It's Astronomy with Dr. Valerie Rapson coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. We welcome back Dr. Valerie Rapson, an associate professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. Valerie earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. The number to call here if you have a question as we roll along is 800-348-2551. Don't be shy. I was just peppering Dr. Rapson with incredibly simple questions that I don't know the answer to, and she looked at me very kindly and said, "Boy, you don't know much." The number here is 800-348-2551. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. It's a no-judgment zone here. You just call 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, how are you?
Yes, oh, I'm good. I think you're putting words in my mouth here,
all
Ray.
Right.
I'm
maybe
always
a little
supportive
bit.
Of good questions.
Well, but were they good questions?
They were.
Don't know. What's new at the college?
Oh, not much. It's just about the end of week three, so we're finally getting in the groove of things.
Yeah.
You know, the students are great.
My
solar system class has been so much fun. We've just been, you know, we're just starting to get into the cool stuff, like planetary orbits and the details of the planets, so I love teaching that.
Sounds like a fun one. Are there any dud students? Any underperformers?
No, never.
You sure?
Everybody's at a slightly different level, but it's my job to bring them all up to the same level and for them to learn good things.
You know, that's a great question. How do you keep it sort of in the middle? So those who are a little advanced don't get bored, and those who don't know as much yet are not snowed under.
Right. Well, that's honestly the challenge of being a professor, is reaching everybody kind of where they're at. And I take the approach, especially with classes like the solar system class, of, you know, showing some cool facts and talking about things, but also doing some of the math behind it and occasionally showing where things came from. Like yesterday we did an activity where I gave them data from the 1500s of where Mars was in the sky. This is exactly what like Copernicus and Kepler and those people did. And I made them plot out the orbit of Mars and do the same thing that people did hundreds of years ago. Now, this was great math practice for those that needed it, but those that were more advanced really felt as if they were being the true scientists and making the discovery.
That's
like
so exciting. You know, you could go to your planetarium and punch in the date, and it would do it for you.
Sure.
So here's a question. In this day of AI and technology that will do so much for people who are still thinking about things, is it detrimental to not do that the old-fashioned way, at least first, so you understand what the technology is doing for you?
Yeah, I think to some extent it is, and this is a big discussion we're having at the college, not just with my students, but with everybody's students, because the learning process is trying and failing and thinking about what's right and wrong. The goal is not to get the assignment perfect the first time. You don't learn anything doing that. So we're still trying to figure out how to teach students to use AI as a tool to help them and not just do the work for them and say it's done, because they're not learning anything when they do that.
Well, the flip side of the coin is really the trick is knowing what to ask.
Right.
And there's the art, knowing the questions to ask to get the proper information.
Exactly. And also realizing when AI is giving you something that's wrong. And that only comes once you have some of that prior knowledge and confidence to say that. Because we were chatting about how, you know, I get astronomy answers from AI all the time, and half the time they're wrong. not because it's making things up, but because it doesn't have the latest information or it wasn't asked the question properly. So it's a challenge as a student when you don't really know how to utilize it.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. All right, you don't have to name names. You don't even have to answer this question.
Uh-oh.
When you give an assignment or have a test, maybe a take-home test, can you spot it when somebody has been using artificial intelligence to get the answers?
Sometimes, yes. One of the things I do, especially for my physics class, is I ask them to draw pictures of like what's happening in the problem before they solve it. And oftentimes they'll draw a picture that doesn't at all match what they actually solved mathematically. And that helps me kind of see, did you really understand what the word problem said? And, you know, not just can somebody else do the math for you? Like, are you actually connecting the two pieces? So sometimes I can do that. And other times it's harder, but We do what we can.
Are you capable of being stern? I don't think I've ever heard you raise your voice.
I'm a pretty nice person. You know, I have my moments, as does everybody.
Oh, not me. I'm very well balanced.
You're just like...
Yeah, exactly.
No, I try my best.
All right. A couple topics you and I were batting about here before the show started.
Sure.
From sciencenews.org, dark matter hunters may have finally spotted a hint of the particles. One day in June 23, the numerous unblinking electronic eyes of the Lux Zeppelin detector may have glimpsed something remarkable, possibly the first direct detection of the shadowy dark matter that pervades the cosmos, or it may have been just another Friday.
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal?
Yeah, so astronomers have been looking for dark matter forever, right? It's this thing that's making stars move too fast and galaxies, and we think that it's literally everywhere. It's in this room, it's where everybody is, it's in our galaxy. And it's really hard to detect because it doesn't interact with light, it doesn't interact with most particles around us, but it does influence things via gravity. So they had to build this giant detector, like this giant vat of xenon atoms, because there's a prediction that the dark matter particles can interact pretty well with these heavier xenon particles. And what they saw, they think, was one dark matter particle come in, smack a xenon atom, kick off some light, some energy, some electrons, and the patterns that they saw might be from a dark matter particle collision. But they're not like 100% sure. They're only like 99%, which isn't quite good enough yet.
Now, I'm reading in this article, and most of it is all Greek to me, but yet, based on physicists' best assessment, there's only about a 1 in 100 chance for known particles to produce the event you just described, a statistical significance of 2.6 sigma.
Mm-hmm.
3 sigma usually needed to claim evidence in physics. 5 sigma is the bar for detection.
Right.
So is this much ado about nothing?
I don't think so. This is a unique detection that really, you know, tossed out some particles and created some signals that we can't explain with any known physics that we have. So regardless of whether this is a dark matter particle or not, we saw something we've never seen before. So there's some new physics that's going to happen no matter what. But it's possible that it was dark matter, and if we see it a second or third time and the same pattern, the same signature emerges, that's when we're going to have the confidence level needed to say we've actually detected dark matter.
Our guest today is Dr. Valerie Rapson, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. This one from the Debrief, debrief.org. An international team of astronomers led by Infrared Submillimeter Group at the Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics has announced the discovery of a star so close to Sagittarius A star, the Milky Way's centrally placed supermassive black hole, that it is experiencing warped space-time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a kind of established science already.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this significant news?
Yeah, this is cool because this star is closer to the central black hole than any other star we've ever seen. It experiences precession, like it makes kind of a flower pattern if you trace out its orbit.
Yeah.
It's exactly what Mercury does around our sun, too. But we're seeing this from the black hole's perspective. And being so close, it also experiences what they call frame dragging, which is when a spinning black hole actually drags and warps space-time around with it, and no other object that we've detected is close enough to experience this. So it's going to change its orbit a little bit, and we can use that orbital change to figure out exactly how fast our black hole is spinning, and there's no other way to do that.
So this is the big takeaway. You can measure the black hole indirectly much better that way.
Yes, yes, because we can do its mass. Like, we've done that already. We know how big the black hole is. We know exactly where it is, all those details. But there's other properties of black holes, like how fast it spins, that we can't physically see. And you need a star this close that's experiencing the space-time spinning to be able to measure that.
By the way, if you want to jump in here, the number is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. All right, you may not be able to answer this one, but if there was life, if I was standing right next to this object or on this object, and I know I couldn't do that.
Sure.
And I was in this warped space-time, what would I experience in that warped space-time?
Yeah, well, it would depend on kind of what you're looking at. If you're looking towards the black hole, you would see bright rings of material around the black hole. And if you're close enough, you might even see, like, the dark center. You would see things actually warping around. But that's from your perspective. From our perspective, like, watching the star, things are relative, right? Things are different. So we are seeing the star's orbit change. We're watching the black hole's spin affect it. But you wouldn't necessarily feel or experience as much because you're experiencing it from a different perspective.
You know, you studied, what, planetary science, planetary formation when you got your PhD,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, star and planet formation, yep.
There are so many niche areas of expertise in this, and it's growing all the time. Does your head ever spin? How do you keep up?
I don't, honestly. Like, you know, I sit here and answer these questions to the best of my ability, but I am not an expert in a lot of these things. I just, you know, you learn the basics, and once you have that core knowledge of astrophysics, you can kind of apply the theories to anything, whether it's star formation or galaxy collisions. It's all the same physics. So as long as you got that down, you can kind of think through anything, but you're right. There's a lot of little niche discoveries and strange things happening that require way more knowledge than I have.
It's so cool. Our guest is Valerie Rapson. One more here, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll go to the email bag and the phones, 800-348-2551. This one from NASA's website. Hubble solves merger mystery from Milky Way's early years. Our home galaxy, the Milky Way, grew to its current size in part by consuming smaller galaxies. We've talked about that before. Now, new data from the Hubble Space Telescope shows definitive evidence of a dwarf galaxy merging with the young Milky Way galaxy in the earliest phases of its evolution. This finding extends our knowledge of our galaxy's history 1.8 billion years further back in time than before.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Yeah, this is kind of cool. We're basically looking at what's called globular clusters, these literal globs of stars that are orbiting our Milky Way galaxy. And we're seeing that there's kind of clumps of stars of different ages and properties all within these globular clusters. And what that really means is that other galaxies collided and merged and interacted with the Milky Way throughout its history to create these different structures of stars. So the reason I found that article was actually not because of, you know, the cool science behind it. It was because of the ridiculous names of galaxies that collided.
Like what?
Like, one of them was the Gaia Sausage Enceladus Galaxy. And I was like, what are we doing? Like,
do we know where that came from?
Well,
there's got to be a reason, right?
Yeah, no, they had reasons. That one was, so Gaia was the telescope that observed it. That's also, like, in Greek mythology, the name of Earth.
Right.
So you got that. Sausage, because the star group that they were observing looked like a sausage.
Right,
apparently.
Delicious, okay.
Uh-huh. And then Enceladus, you know, again, in mythology, I think that was like the giant that got buried under a mountain. And the idea was, well, we're looking at stars buried in a star cluster. So it's kind of the same analogy. So we're just putting Greek mythology directly together with physical observations.
Well, you know,
and naming it that. So.
There's this book, I can say the name. You always hear the advertisement, oh, get your name in the, name a star after yourself in the registry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We should do that with galaxies.
And
you
just
come
start
up with your own.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, so let's take a quick break here. 800-348-2551. It's Valerie Rapson. It's Astronomy. We go to the email bag and the phones in a moment. So, you know, the live event a week from this past Tuesday over at DeFazio's 216 in Troy is a sellout, I believe, although you can always check and see if there are cancellations, but I don't think so. There are so many on-the-road events at WAMC. If you go to wamc.org/on-the-road, you're going to find out about all these things that are happening in and around your communities. I recommend you give it a try and join us at one of these things. It's Vox Pop, and our guest today is Dr. Valerie Rapson, an associate professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. Let's do a couple emails before we hit the phones. 800-348-2551. This one is from Fred. Sometime in 2029, the asteroid Apophis will fly really close to Earth. I read about 20,000 miles. Though we don't expect it to crash into Earth, I believe that it is closer than most of our communication satellites. What's the chance of it taking out a bunch of satellites? And does that mean I'll lose the ability to listen to WAMC for an extended period? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. 20,000 miles is pretty close.
That is really close. And I'm glad we have the capability to monitor these things, because we do want to know when something that close is coming. But the good news is it's not directly headed for that ring of geosynchronous satellites, because they're primarily around Earth's equator. So we don't have to worry about it knocking out too many satellites. There's always a chance, a very small one, that an asteroid's going to come by and just happen to hit a satellite around Earth. But we're pretty good at predicting exactly where these things are. And most satellites have the ability to shift a little bit in space.
Even those in geosynchronous orbit?
Potentially, yeah.
Wow.
If we nudge it just a little bit, and it doesn't have to be much, that can cause it to shift far enough away. I mean, we wouldn't want to move them too long because they could be no longer geosynchronous anymore.
Now, how far out do they have to be geosynchronous?
About 22,000 miles.
So it is in that, the 20,000 miles.
It's like right on the edge there. So,
by the way, that is really close in the astronomical game.
Yeah, the moon's like 240,000 miles.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking an order of magnitude closer. So, yeah, and, you know, we've been watching Apophis for a long time because it has made many close approaches to Earth before, and this is just going to be another one.
Oh, man. It scares me all the same, because if you've got a decimal point wrong, way, way down.
Uh-huh. I mean, they have made these kinds of mistakes before. Thankfully, not with tracking asteroids, but, you know, there was that classic mistake for the Mars satellite, the weather satellite.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the metric to American unit conversions, and, you know, you lose a decimal place, and you crash a satellite onto Mars.
Forget to carry the one.
Exactly.
Okay, Ken writes in, the blight named Starlink, says Ken. How many times has Dr. Rapson gotten artifacts in her astrophotos from Starlink satellites crossing the field of view?
A whole bunch. You know, when we're doing our exoplanet work at the observatory, at least a couple of times a night. And, you know, and we're not taking pictures all night long. But let's say at least once an hour, I get a couple of pictures where there's a satellite in the way. And we don't know if it's Starlink or something else. It could be any one of the satellites. But it is getting pretty annoying, especially when it goes like right across the object that you're trying to look at or observe, because then you got to toss your image away. But
I mean, there's no escaping this. The amount of launches, we don't even know all of the military launches, but the commercial launches alone are just an astronomical number of satellites up there.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back even to when I was a kid in the 70s, seeing a satellite was something of a cool thing. You say, I saw a satellite.
Right.
Now you go up, you look up for 2 minutes, you see a satellite.
And they're there, yeah. No, and there's more and more companies these days that are trying to do the same thing. And it's good that we have competition, but bad in the sense that that means there's going to be more satellites to worry about.
Yeah, they're coming. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us today. It's astronomy. Chris writes in, is there climate change going on with our sister planets?
Well,
we know Venus became a, greenhouse effect pretty fast.
Right. So, I mean, in the very broad sense of what climate change means, which is just literally the changing of a climate, yeah, the answer is yes. There's different reasons for it on different planets. You know, as you mentioned, Venus has had volcanic activity ever since the beginning, and that's pumping tons of CO2 and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So it's ridiculously hot because of that. But Mars sees climate change, too. Its atmosphere is being stripped away by the sun. Earlier on in its history, it too had volcanic eruptions. It had water on the surface. So those types of things have caused the climate and atmospheres to change on all of the planets. There's no humans there, you know, producing the greenhouse gases, but there's a lot of natural climate change happening everywhere in the solar system.
Venus is interesting, though. Do we have a sense of when it wasn't so violently horrible, where it's thousands of degrees and the atmospheric pressure is insane.
No.
Only a couple of landers have ever made it, and only for a handful of minutes, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think the longest was like an hour and a half or so, one of the Soviet landers back in the day. It's been pretty terrible for quite a while. It's hard to really model and figure out when it could be calmer, because it's still volcanically active today. And without being able to monitor the surface more easily, we can't really tell how volcanically active it was in the past. We just know that there were volcanoes, which means there's lots of greenhouse gases, and it's been hot for a long time.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Now, how close to the sun is Venus? It's our nearest neighbor, right?
Well, yes. It depends. Depends on when you're talking, but technically, yes. If you're thinking about all the planets lined up, it's closer to us than Mars.
So this would be in the so-called Goldilocks zone, right?
Right on the inner edge, yes, potentially.
It's a real shame that it isn't what the sci-fi thought it was in the 30s,
right.
40s, and 50s, is mm-hmm. lush, beautiful.
Yeah, you
sister
know, like
planet.
If it's just a beach under there or something, I can guarantee you there's no beautiful beach. There's no water.
I've seen the pictures from Venera.
It's 850 degrees Fahrenheit, acid rain, totally miserable place to be.
I'm sure you've seen the photos of the Soviet lander. I think it was Venera, right? It was a hellscape.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just barren. It looks like dry, crackly mud everywhere. You can't even see the sun. Like, you can tell it's daytime, but you can't see the sun through the clouds.
That's something else. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Nick writes in, how big does the sun look from the moon? How bright is it on the moon? Are there special visors to see when in space or on the moon? Would an eclipse of Earth and the sun be possible to see from the moon? A lot of questions from Nick.
And these are great questions for my solar system class, and I might steal some of them for homework assignments.
I'll give you the sheet.
Because we basically do all of these calculations, right? How big is the sun from Earth's perspective, or the moon, or Mars's perspective? We could do all of that. But the short answer is the sun doesn't look that much different from the moon's perspective, because the moon is basically at Earth, right? We're both about 93 million miles from the sun at all times. So the sun's going to look about the same size as it does from Earth's perspective standing on the moon.
Yeah.
But if you're thinking about like eclipses, the Earth is much bigger than the moon. So if you're standing on the moon and you're looking towards the sun and the Earth goes in between, the Earth is very easily going to cover up the sun.
So
when
we
get a lunar eclipse, the moon basically gets a solar eclipse because the Earth is crossing in front.
Same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, exactly.
Of course.
It's just change in perspective.
Interesting. It's cool to think of it that way.
Yeah.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Tell you what, let's grab a couple of calls, and then we'll go back to the email bag. If you want to email, it's voxpop@wamc.org. John's in Hyde Park. Hello there, John.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question regarding gravity.
Okay.
According to Einstein's general relativity, mass warps space-time.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is in space-time that is bent by the mass?
That is the ultimate question, right? So when we talk about this, we're told to say, you know, think about the universe and the fabric of space-time as like a rubber sheet, right? And when you're bending it, what you're really doing is bending that sheet. But space-time is really just kind of filled with energy. And we don't really have a great analogy of describing like physically what it is, because it is nothing. It is a vacuum that still possesses some energy. And what the gravity is doing is really affecting something traveling through that vacuum. And that's what we're seeing. So we say it's warping space-time, but it's really affecting the motion of material through the vacuum.
And that's quantum material?
Any material.
Go ahead, John.
We're thinking in terms of an imaginary grid that's being bent.
Yeah.
And things are programmed to go to cross that grid at certain locations,
mm-hmm.
and those locations are moving closer and closer to the mass.
Right,
is that
right.
What we're doing here?
Yeah, basically. I mean, the grid is just something to help your brain wrap around nothing, because the very simple answer is nothing. There's nothing there. It's a very thin vacuum, only a handful of particles that are there. But these massive objects are just affecting material traveling through it. And if you view it as a grid that can be bent, then you can actually visualize what's happening, but there is no real grid or fabric there.
Makes
sense. That we know of.
Yeah. That we know of, yeah.
All right, John.
The computer universe might argue with the case, but...
What was that last line there, John? What'd you say?
I say a computer universe theory might explain that.
Hologram.
Now we're in the Matrix, right?
Oh, very interesting. All right, thanks, John, for bringing that up. Now we'll take 12 calls on that. 800-348-2551 is the number. It is hard to visualize.
Yeah.
You can't visualize an infinite universe. It's impossible to do that, right? For me, it's impossible when they say, oh, yes, the universe is essentially flat.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you really?
It's everything.
Right. Right. And it has no bounds. So we say, OK, well, think of a sheet of paper. Like, that's three dimensional technically, but it's flat. But then how do you think of that as infinitely large?
Yeah.
Right. You can't, like, there's no easy way to literally wrap your head around these
or
things.
Something that had no beginning or came from nothing. If the Big Bang is to be believed.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't even imagine such
know.
A thing. And yet arithmetic can take care of that for us, right?
Right, math says no problem.
Yeah, just blame it on dark matter. All right, let's go to Abigail in Kingston. Abigail, you're on.
Oh, wow. Great show.
Thank you.
Such intelligent listeners. I am so impressed, Valerie.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for all this wonderful stuff. I remember, and I've said this before on another show, the way of memorizing things or remembering things was Mary's velvet eyes makes March stay up late nights, dot Pluto. So when you were talking about the closeness to the moon, that came back to me. I think it was the moon or the sun now, but this is just wonderful. And thank you guys for talking about this stuff.
Hey, Abigail.
Possibly, we, what?
How was your birthday party?
Oh, it was lovely. I had two of them, or three of them, were celebrated.
Good for you. That's great.
And I brought it. And I brought a cake for the Woodstock Festival Market, and everybody enjoyed it. It was just absolutely wonderful.
Outstanding.
But I just want to tell you how much I love this station and what we do. And so anyway, I'm going to hang up now and give other people a chance to ask questions.
All right. Be good, Abigail.
And is Mary's velvet eyes makes John stay up night?
Ah, Mary's velvet eyes make John stay. That's how you remember the planets.
The planets
do you do that to your students? Right.
Yes, maybe not that phrase. Yes.
Hey, Abigail, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, and let's go to Raphael in Kingston. Raphael, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I have been fascinated with Jupiter most of my adult life, if not earlier, but I'm now learning about the moons of Jupiter.
Yeah.
And I'm very fascinated by Ganymede. I can't eat. So this moon is bigger than Mercury.
Yep.
And what is it made out of?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, yeah, there are some planets in the solar system like Ganymede and Titan that are bigger than some of our planets. So, yeah, Ganymede is huge. It's the biggest of all of the moons. And it's primarily made of rock. They actually think that there could be a really deep subsurface ocean, not one that we could ever, like, drill down and get to. We're talking, like, hundreds of miles below the surface.
How would they have that theory? If it's so far down that we could never even check it.
Yeah, well, some of it has to do with just the overall density of the moon, thinking about, okay, if it was pure rock or pure metal, it would be one density.
Oh.
If it's a lower density, it might have some liquid layers.
Yeah.
You can also take a look at the surface and see if any water has, like, upwelled throughout its history, kind of look for evidence that way, or even like atmospheric effects. I don't think Ganymede really has, you know, much air of any kind around it, maybe a little bit, but sometimes there's particles that are remnants of that. So water might exist there potentially. But it's pretty much just a big solid rock, heavily cratered, very similar to Earth's moon in that respect. But, you know, silicates, rocky material is the main composition.
Raphael.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Some of the moons of Jupiter have interesting atmospheres of sorts, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Saturn as well. One of them has like hydrocarbons for an atmosphere, right? There are big lakes of hydro carbons
on Saturn? Yeah, you're thinking of
Saturn.
Titan's atmosphere is a lot of nitrogen in it, but it does have methane lakes.
Yeah, amazing.
So yeah, like instead of water, it's just literally liquid natural gas almost. Like that's kind of how I describe it. And my students are like, what are you talking about? Like that's insane. But the temperatures and the pressures are just right for all of that to happen.
You know, to me, it always harkens back to a Star Trek episode where Spock says, oh, this is silicon-based life.
Yeah.
Could it be in your wildest imagination that there could be a life form that says, oh, I'm going down to the methane lake. I'm going to have a swim.
Uh-huh.
In other words, a completely different biosystem.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you totally can. It's not as easy to kind of biologically create and think about a silicon-based life form compared to a carbon-based life form, but there are theories out there. And places like methane lakes might be better places for them because they wouldn't rely on water. They would rely on hydrogen or hydrocarbons and things like that as their fuel and their main body composition, if you want to think of it that way. So, yeah, silicon-based life form is wild.
That's incredible.
Could be out there.
Let's take a quick break here. It's 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. If you want to weigh in on the whole astronomy thing, we'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you, joined by Dr. Valerie Rapson, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. And by the way, if people want to find out about the planetarium, it's open to the public sometimes,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes, it
is. How do they do that?
Yeah, we're starting our planetarium shows this weekend. So Friday nights and Saturdays, the SUNY Oneonta website.
What's on the show?
So one of my graduate students is working on a show called Planetary Nebula, Ghosts of the Cosmos.
Ooh, explain.
Yeah, that'll be our Friday night show. She's working on basically thinking about when the sun dies and explodes. It doesn't really explode, but when it releases its outer layers, what is it going to look like? And what's going to happen to the planets in the solar system? And she's actually been working with some researchers at RIT, where I did my graduate work, taking some of their real telescope data and modeling it for use in the planetarium. So she's working on a whole show
about
this.
That is incredible.
Yeah, so we're excited.
You've touched upon it, and it has been a fear of mine since I was about 9. The Earth is going to go red giant at some point,
yep.
right? And probably we'll be on the edge. We'll get engulfed, right?
We're going to be right on the border of like when the sun puffs up for that red giant. We may or may not get consumed by the sun. It's going to depend on exactly how big it gets. And even if we survive this, we still have to worry about the fluctuations of the sun, like pulsing, when it tosses out its layers. And not even to mention the hotness and the brightness is going to be right on top of us now. So our Earth is not going to live long past the red giant phase of the sun.
Why does a star like ours, which is a class what? It's a
G2.
G2.
Yes.
Why does it shed layers at the end game?
Because it's very unstable. So right now, the sun is peaceful. People should not worry about what we're talking about.
I did for a long time.
We're good now. It's fusing hydrogen into helium, very stable. But eventually, the sun's going to run out of that hydrogen fuel. And when the fusion stops briefly, that's when things get a little crazy. The inner star collapses, the outer star puffs out, and the fusion rate changes, and the temperatures on the inside change, and the star literally pulses outward and inward in an attempt to get back to like an equilibrium. It wants to stay at constant temperature and pressure and just keep fusing hydrogen or helium throughout its whole life. But because it's unstable, it keeps running out of fuel in the middle. It does this pulsing to try and get back to normal, and it fails and eventually explodes.
And your planetarium or your students' planetarium show Friday night talks about what happens after that. Our star is not hot enough or dense enough to become a dwarf of any kind?
So it's not big enough to become a supernova. That's what, when we say like stars exploding, that's really what we think about. You know, our sun is going to shed its outer layers in a not so violent explosion or multiple ones throughout its life. But when it does that, the only thing that's going to be left is the white dwarf.
Oh, there is going to be a white dwarf.
Yeah. So the core of the star will be left over, and that will remain at the center of our solar system forever. Even if all the planets get destroyed, the white dwarf will still be there.
What will fuel it forever?
Well, nothing. So white dwarfs, they're basically just primarily carbon and maybe a little hydrogen and helium that's still left over, and they will just sit there and cool off.
Will it solidify eventually?
I mean, it's kind of already solid, just depending on what you're thinking of what it's made of. Eventually it is going to cool off and kind of just fizzle out. We won't really see any light. And there's tons of white dwarfs out there that we're finally discovering with our big telescopes because they're so small and cold that we weren't able to see them before.
Well, if they've fizzled out, why call them white dwarfs? Are they white?
Well, they start out really hot. They start out really bright white and maybe even like emitting in the UV and X-ray spectrum. But I mean, that's just the name that we use in the beginning, but eventually they won't look so white anymore.
All right. I think you've had enough of my inane questions. Let's go back to the emails here and see if Joe in LaGrangeville can do better. Subject heading, detecting life on other planets. I've been wanting to ask this question for over a year. Wasn't sure if this is an astronomy question or a science question, but either way, I'd like Valerie to try it out. Let's assume there is an advanced civilization on a Goldilocks planet neighboring a nearby star that has roughly the same degree of technology that we do. Okay. If they pointed all their telescopes and other instruments toward us, would they be able to find, see, detect evidence of life here, either general abundant life or of actual advanced human technology?
Mm.
That's a great question. No, I don't know how
really
you answer that. But
no, I think I have an idea. So if they have similar technology to us and they're not too far away in the universe, like if they're on our side of the galaxy, close-ish,
right.
They would definitely be able to see the Earth transit in front of the sun, cross in front of the sun, as long as the angles are right. And if they have the spectrographs that tell us what material is made of, they would be able to detect Earth's atmosphere. And what they would see is what we call biosignatures, things like water and methane, the type of elements that are here because life is on this planet. So that's really what we're looking for around some of these other Earth-sized planets is those biosignatures. An atmosphere rich in oxygen and water and methane, the only way we know for that to be possible is for there to be life on that planet. And they would see that here for us.
All right. But have we seen it elsewhere?
Not yet. No. We're getting closer. We are just having the technology to be able to get the ones to see the planets that are Earth-sized with atmospheres around them. But, you know, I'm thinking like in the next 10 years, that's when we're really going to be able to see more of that information and maybe see something like that.
All right. If AI doesn't wipe out the human race in
the next
10 years.
Yeah, right. That's the science segment you got to talk there.
That's another show. Kurt in Cahoe says, I understand that the planets circle the sun in an ellipse pattern, not in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
At what time of the year is the Earth closest to the sun, and when is it furthest away? And that's from Kurt in Cahoe.
Yeah, so this is going to be totally counterintuitive. You would think that we are closest to the sun in summer and farthest away in winter, because that would make logical sense, but it's actually the opposite. We're actually 2 or 3 million miles closer to the sun in winter, and a little bit farther away in summer.
I did not know that.
Yeah, because the seasons really have to do with the Earth's tilt. It has nothing to do with how close or far away we are. So that's just the way it happens to work out for us. So, you know, roughly June is the farthest point, and roughly December is the closest point.
Now, I don't know if I have the term right. I don't know if it's precession or not. 20,000 some odd years.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that to me. Just quickly before we go back to
the
phones.
Yeah, so I mean, precession means a lot of things, but if you're talking about like the tilt of Earth changing.
The Earth's precession.
Mm-hmm. So we kind of like, if you imagine us like a spinning top, it kind of wobbles a little bit back and forth. And we're going to change a few degrees in our tilt over the tens of thousands of years. And the observable thing that we're going to see is our North Star will not always be our North Star. We're going to be pointed in a slightly different direction, and eventually we're just going to lose the North Star completely.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson. Let's go to Paul in Schenectady. Paul.
Hello. Yeah, I just bought a telescope, and I live in Schenectady. I'm just wondering if there's some sort of like website or a map that can tell me where I can go that had the least light pollution so I can get a clear view of the sky.
Mm. Yeah, I would go anywhere south where you are, because you want the bigger cities and things to be north of you, because most of the exciting stuff to look at is in your southern sky. So pick a dark park that is safe to be at night, that's somewhere south of Schenectady or maybe south of Albany too, and bring it there. You can also check out the Albany Area Amateur Astronomers. They have different state parks and things where they do star parties at, and you can take their advice too.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. I got to do that one of these times.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Want to go look through telescopes. By the way, the telescope at SUNY Oneonta, which is pretty enormous by local standards, mm-hmm. it never opens to the public?
I know. You asked me this like every other show.
I love it, though. I want to go.
I know. We've been focusing so hard on getting it research ready and hooking up the cameras. We haven't scheduled anything yet, but I promise I will tell people.
You don't have to promise
me. You can
me.
Come anytime.
I understand it's the college's thing, and you probably don't want the public hanging around. You want us to go and take courses.
No, it's not that I don't want you there. It's just it's on the top of this mountain, and it's a bit of a challenge to coordinate with the weather, but it is really cool.
I know what I'm not wanted. I'm going to Chris in Sheffield, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on.
Hi, Valerie and Ray. Thank you. I love this show. It's awesome.
Thank you.
I had a quick question for Valerie. With your knowledge of space and, like, just your different views from, like, all these different planets and looking back at Earth, does it ever affect the way that you think of how sometimes the pettiness between humans occurs?
Mm.
And I'll hang up just to listen to the answer on the radio, and I appreciate the show.
What a great question.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I agree. You know, when you really start to look at Earth from that perspective, right, there's that classic picture of, you know, when the Voyagers left the solar system and they looked back at Earth, and it's just this teeny little blue dot. You know, it really puts into perspective that we are all one people on a planet, and I wish we could all get along better because this is our home. We aren't going to be traveling interstellar travel anytime soon. There's nowhere else in the solar system to go. So it does make me feel really small, and it makes me more hopeful that more people will recognize that we're all just one people on this Earth.
You know, when Shatner went into space, I think one of his comments, and I don't know exactly why he said it, but he was saddened at some point.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why, just maybe because of humanity's scourge.
Right, exactly. There's no borders, you know. When you're looking from the perspective of the moon down to Earth, you can see the continents, but nobody's drawing any lines, right? We're all just one on this planet.
So you don't think that given the technological advances that we will not see interstellar travel within the next 50 to 100 years?
I
think we will.
It's tough. I think maybe we could get some robotic type of interstellar travel. Human-based interstellar travel is the tricky part, right? Because keeping people alive for the time frame that it's going to take to do this and getting those spacecrafts accelerated fast enough to get to a star in a reasonable amount of time with a human on board, that's something we haven't been able to figure out yet. Like, that's just physics 101 that we can't get past.
I mean, we would have to construct something like that in space, right?
Potentially, yeah. Because, I mean, that's the other challenge is if you could build a big enough spaceship, how do you get it off of Earth? How do you get it away from Earth's gravity enough to then be pushed to go fast enough to get to another star? Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, maybe the engineers are cooking up something really good. It wouldn't surprise me if we did, like, solar sails or some sort of cool small spacecraft to another star sometime soon. That thing has been proposed. But humans, that's another issue.
The solar sail, though, that would take a long time to get up to speed, right?
It would if you're using purely the sun. There was some talk about actually shining lasers, high-powered lasers, at these types of sails and using the energy and the light from the lasers to accelerate them. And that could get you to another star in a human lifetime.
That is amazing.
Yeah, they haven't quite figured out the physics. You know, they talked about this for a while and then gave up. So there must be something else that's causing a bit of a challenge for actually doing it. But they're thinking about it.
All right. Michael writes in, why are all the planets on the same plane in their revolutions?
That's also physics 101, because our planetary system, when it formed, was spinning. So you take a big cloud of gas and dust and you spin it up really fast. Physics is just going to flatten it out into a disk. To conserve momentum, everything naturally flattens out if you spin it fast enough. And that means that when you have just a disk around the sun, all the planets are going to form in that disk. So they're all going to form in the same rough plane around the sun.
So the universe can't spin, right? Because it's everything? Is it even possible for the universe to be rotating?
Well, there's been some articles recently, some arguing yes, some arguing no, depending on what you look at. We think the universe is flat for different reasons other than spinning. We think the Big Bang and inflation is what caused it to become flat, not that it's spinning very rapidly. But people have looked at the motions of distant galaxies and galaxy clusters to try and see if there's like an extra little angle in one direction suggesting a spin. And I don't think they've concretely found anything like that yet.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. It's astronomy. Sometimes we do this show, and I wish we had 2 or 3 hours, and this is one of those times. Let's go to Richard in Rensselaer. Richard, you're on.
Hi. There was a report recently about this super-fast neutrino that packed a whole lot of wallop and can only do that by being very, 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 very fast. And I just want to know how do they think it was a neutrino that has virtually no mass?
Mm. Yeah, I'm not super familiar with this one. I haven't seen this article, so I'll have to go look more. But whenever you have neutrinos striking objects, or really any particle, going back to the dark matter thing, thinking about that, there is a different signature that you get when a neutrino versus a dark matter particle versus a literal piece of mass that hits something. So different energies will come out of the material that it strikes. Different particles will come out in the production. So it must be that they were looking at what was produced in the form of light and particles, and they matched that back to a neutrino collision.
Richard.
So you're saying dark matter, even though we don't know what it is, it still has a signature that you can identify?
Good question.
Well, yeah, that's what we're trying to figure out, right? We don't know what it is. We have some theories and some predictions of the signature that it might produce. But the recent discovery of where we think it hit the xenon atom, it produced the signature that was not predicted by any of our current theories, which is also why we're just hesitating slightly about being confident that it was actually a dark matter detection. So there's a lot we don't know still about how all this works in, like, the quantum realm like that.
All right, Richard, thanks a lot. Well, how much mass does a neutrino generally have?
Well, I think neutrinos are pretty low mass, and they're neutral particles. So
meaning?
They don't interact, like, electromagnetically very much. They're
okay.
Neutral. Like, protons are positive, electrons are negative.
Right.
Neutrino, neutral.
Right.
Yeah. So they're pretty low, and they don't interact very much. We get tons of them from the sun flying through us every day, and we don't feel them.
So looping back to the dark matter, in order to make a reaction like they say they saw with what? You said xenon?
Yeah, they're using xenon.
Would it have to have mass to do that? Could we learn something about what it is?
Yeah. So it definitely has to have mass of some kind because it interacts gravitationally. Otherwise, you wouldn't see that at all. If you have no mass, then you're not going to have that same gravitational interaction that we normally expect.
I'll tell you what. It's amazing to have you here. And if people would like to find out more about what you do, I mean, it's a college. You can't just walk in and take classes. But if people are interested, how do they do that?
Yeah. Well, the planetarium's always a great place to start. You can visit me and my students there. You know, SUNY Oneonta's website has planetarium information. And people can audit courses. You know, I'd love to have some listeners come sit in the back of my intro astronomy classes.
How do you do that?
Learn a little bit. You have to sign up officially as a student. Unfortunately, you can't just walk in and sit down. I mean, I wouldn't mind, but if 100 of our listeners all of a sudden show up in my class, there might be a problem.
Could you imagine if I went and audited your course? That would be very bad for everyone.
You should. See if anybody recognizes your voice when you ask questions.
Well, I would write them down and hand them to you. You know,
See, don't be embarrassed.
It's only been about 44 years since I've taken an astronomy course, so I think things are a little different now.
But that's the fun, right? Like, all of my students coming in, they don't know very much. I mean, maybe they watched some YouTube videos, maybe they watched or you know, had a class, but it's my job to teach you all that fun new stuff.
Dr. Valerie Rapson, you're the best. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next month. Support comes from Shaker Heritage Society, announcing their Harvest Craft Fair this Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 4, featuring local artisans, demonstrations, music, tours, and farm animal encounters. ShakerHeritage.org. Thanks again to Dr. Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thank you for listening. Great calls and emails. Smartest listeners in the world right here. And if you're really smart, you remember that the lockbox is open at WAMC.org. Fun drive is coming, you know. Every dollar we raise shortens that drive. Thanks to Mike Bowen, our engineer. Susie Chekai screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow at 2, it's Food Friday, and we'll check in with Anissa Waheed of Tara Kitchen. I'll tell you what, she is a force of nature, that one. It's always great catching up with her. Tomorrow is the 25th anniversary of 9/11, and Anissa was in New York City that day, so we'll touch upon that a little bit as well. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.